Welcome, friends, to another week where we get to worship and learn the way of Jesus together. Thanks for being here. We're continuing in our series we've been in for the past several weeks where we're learning practices for spiritual formation. And tonight we're going to talk about the practice known as Sabbath, all right? And one of the things that I love about Sabbath, I think it's super unique, and to be honest, I've been kind of looking forward to this particular topic throughout the rest of this, throughout the previous weeks in the series. And Sabbath is super unique. It's the only spiritual discipline that's also a commandment, like one of the 10 commandments. The fourth commandment is to keep the Sabbath. So this has been really, really, really important as a spiritual practice throughout the life of the church, even before the church was the church, back in the days of the nation of Israel, when that was God's covenant people. So it has a really, really ancient history to it, but it is super life-giving, super restful, super important for us to practice it today as followers of Jesus. So I want to remind us as we get going tonight of the definition of spiritual formation that we've been using throughout the whole series, all right? So if you're following our notes, spiritual formation, it's a process of being formed in the image of Christ for the sake of others. Process of being formed in the image of Christ for the sake of others. So that's the big idea that we've been talking about with each of these specific disciplines or habits or practices week in and week out in this series. There's a movie that came out back in the 80s called Chariots of Fire. And this movie, it follows the true story of Great Britain's track and field team at the 1924 Olympics held in Paris. And most of the movie centers on this guy, one guy in particular named Eric Little. And he's got a great storyline there. It actually connects a lot to Sabbath. But there's another character in another scene, another quote that really grips me in this movie, something that I think is really memorable. And it's not from Eric Little, it's from a guy named Harold Abrahams. Harold Abrahams was somebody who was supposed to compete in the 100-meter dash in place of Eric Little, because Eric Little, based on a Christian conviction, decided he wasn't going to compete because the race is going to be held on a Sunday. And so he had this personal conviction about not competing on the Sabbath. And so he decided he wasn't going to run. So Harold Abrahams now has this moment thrust upon him, and Eric Little was supposed to be the favorite, the shoe-in. Everybody thought he's going to win this thing, and then he steps out, and so it's now Abraham's turn to kind of take up the mantle and win one for the team. And so there's this conversation that he has about the pressure and the anxiety that he feels with another teammate, another friend of his, like an hour or so before the gold medal race and the 100-meter dash. And this is what he has to say. Check out his perspective here. He says, "I'm forever in pursuit, and I don't even know what I am chasing. But now in 1 hour's time, I'll be out there again. I'll raise my eyes and look down that corridor, 4 feet wide, with 10 lonely seconds to justify my own existence." When he says that in the movie, it's just a super powerful moment. I don't know if that resonates with you at all, the idea of having to perform and produce to justify our own existence. But so much of the time, it feels to me like we wake up in the morning and we go about our day and our routines. You go to school, you work, you do sports, dance, music, whatever, social media. You do your job, you do your chores, you maintain your relationships. You do all this stuff in the hopes that at the end of the day, at the end of your life, you've justified your own existence, that it's mattered, it's meant something, you've added value, you've contributed, you've belonged, right? You've earned praise and affection and love, and like, this has all been worth something. You have to justify your own existence through your work. And if that's you, and if you ever had the thought as you've evaluated where you're at and your ability to do that, like, I don't have enough. I can't give enough. I am not enough. Not enough capacity, not enough gifting, not enough time. If that's ever crossed your mind, if you ever felt the weight of those emotions and that feeling, that thought, then tonight I hope to present to you a gift in the Sabbath. That is what the Sabbath is. It is probably the only spiritual discipline that throughout the ages has been thought of as a gift to human beings from God. Like from God's own heart, he has given us this practice of keeping Sabbath, observing Sabbath, remembering the Sabbath. And it is a gift for our weary, tired, exhausted, performing and producing souls. And for our bodies and our minds and all of us as well. So here's what I want to tell us that the Sabbath teaches us. In your notes, it says this. I don't have to produce and perform. I can rest and be with God, and that's enough. I'm enough because he's enough. I'm enough because he is enough. So I get to rest, I get to be with him, I get a break from the hamster wheel of life, don't have to produce, then I perform. This is a sacred moment in time set aside to just be with God. And so I want to focus our time tonight unpacking the why and the how of practicing Sabbath. But before we get there, we need a basic understanding of what the Sabbath is and what it is biblically, what it is historically, what it is theologically. Like, what is its significance? How has it been practiced? What does the Bible have to say about this practice? How does it fit into the storyline of the Bible, right? The Bible has this meta-narrative. It has this big, grand picture and a story arc that spans all the way from Genesis to Revelation, and it cuts right through the ministry and the life of Jesus. And there's a lot of different threads within that storyline of the Bible, but one of the main themes, the main threads, is Sabbath. And so you can almost trace like the whole flow, the whole narrative arc of Scripture as you watch what happens with the flow and the development of the idea of keeping Sabbath. And I love to communicate all of that and more, but to be honest, there are some people at an organization called Bible Project that will do it way better than I can. So I'm going to show you guys a video here. It's just a few minutes long, but it is going to walk us through this theme of keeping Sabbath and show us how that storyline developed over time, just to ground us in what the Sabbath is in Scripture and in theology, and we'll take it from there to the why and the how we practice Sabbath. So take a look at this video.
The number seven is a big deal in the Bible.
Yeah, in biblical Hebrew, the word seven is connected to the idea of fullness or completeness.
And that's something we all long for, but don't often experience. Instead, we find ourselves working endlessly, fighting back chaos with no real rest.
Yes. Now keep all that in mind as we turn to Genesis 1 in the Bible. It begins with darkness and disorder, but then God speaks to bring about light and order so that life can flourish.
And this happens over the course of 6 days.
Each day is marked with the phrase, there was evening and there was morning. But on the seventh day, something special happens.
God stops and rests.
Right. Creation is brought to its completion on the seventh day. And that phrase, there was evening and there was morning, it doesn't appear on day seven.
It's like a day with no end.
On the seventh day, God's presence fills his creation. The land provides for all of God's creatures, including humans, who are appointed to rule the world with God forever.
Kings and queens of the seventh day rest. I can get into that.
But the humans are deceived by a dark power, and they forfeit that rest. They're exiled into the wilderness, where they have to work as slaves to the land.
Until they die and return to the dust from which they came.
But God wants to restore humanity back to that seventh-day rest. So he chooses to give the family of Israel that experience of ultimate rest so they can share it with others.
But how? They're in Egypt, slaves to an oppressive empire who's grinding them into the dust.
So God confronts Egypt and he liberates the Israelites, taking them through the darkness and chaos on the way to the Promised Land.
Now, while they're on their way, they find themselves in the wilderness. It's easy to get lost. Life is a struggle. They're not in the land of rest yet.
But while they're on the way, God invites them in the wilderness to start living as if they're in the Promised Land.
But how do you practice the future rest in the wilderness?
Well, God tells them that every seventh day they are to stop their work, or in Hebrew, to Shabbat, so that they can rest and enjoy God's good world.
So take a whole day to live as if the ultimate rest has already come.
Yeah, this is the Sabbath, celebrated every week on the seventh day. But there's more. The Sabbath is just one of seven festivals that Israel practiced every year, each one anticipating that seventh day rest.
That is a lot of sevens.
And there's even more. Every 7 years, the Israelites were to liberate slaves, forgive debts, and let the land rest for a whole year. And then, every 7 times 7 years was the ultimate seventh day rest, called the Year of Jubilee. If anyone had lost their land or gone into debt, all was forgiven, everything restored.
Wow, so the Sabbath, these feasts, the Year of Jubilee, it's all pointing towards the hope of future rest.
Right. Now, when the Israelites went into the land, they forgot their God, and so they forfeited their chance to rest in the promised land.
They're exiled and enslaved again by an oppressive nation, led back into a world of chaos and disorder.
But Israel's prophets said that their exile would end one day, and that the ultimate jubilee of freedom and rest would come, but generations go by, and they're still waiting.
It's at this dark point in the story that Jesus appears, and he launches his public mission on a Sabbath day.
Yeah, he read aloud from the scroll of Isaiah, saying that it was time for all captives and slaves to be released because this was the year of the Lord's favor.
What did he mean, this is the year of the Lord's favor?
He was talking about the ultimate jubilee.
Also, Jesus is claiming that seventh-day rest would come through him.
Right. He said that he was the Lord of the Sabbath, and he confronted disorder and darkness in all of its forms, liberating people from sickness, sin, even from death itself.
Yet, Jesus was killed, so even his work was undone.
Well, it seemed that way. But notice, Jesus timed his death to take place at the end of the week. His body rested in a tomb during the Sabbath, and on the eighth day, he rose from the dead.
Oh, wait, the eighth day? You mean the first day of a new week.
Exactly. Jesus' resurrection was like the first day of a new creation, where God's light and life broke into the darkness.
So because of the resurrection, we have hope in God's promise of future rest. But we're not there yet. It's like we're still in the wilderness, where we experience struggle and pain.
But as we journey towards that ultimate seventh day, Jesus invites us to experience a taste of real rest now by following him. Or in his words, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest.
So that's the big picture. And I can tell that was way more better, well done. I don't know what I'm trying to say. It was better than I could have described it, I guess. But that's the grand storyline of Sabbath in the Bible. So when we talk about the practice of Sabbath, there's this whole world, this whole story that is in the back of our minds, and we approach the scriptures and we learn about the Sabbath and how to practice and how to keep the Sabbath in our lives today. So in your notes, I said it this way. The story of the Bible, the story of history, is a story about Sabbath given, Sabbath given up, and Sabbath given back. Sabbath given, Sabbath given up, and Sabbath given back. That's the storyline of the Bible as it's seen through the lens, through the frame of Sabbath. Now, at a very, very basic level, right, very, very basic, Sabbath is just the Hebrew word, the Hebrew term for the last day of the week, what we would now call Saturday, right? But Saturday is a Roman term, right? So back then, Saturday wasn't a thing. The last day of the seven-day week, the Jewish people, they called Shabbat or Sabbath. And the Jewish culture was the first, they were the first people group to actually practice and implement a seven-day week that was built around a day of rest. Think about the fact that we have a seven-day week. Like, that's relatively arbitrary. There's not necessarily, you know, anything with the sun or moon that dictates a regular, unbroken seven-day pattern of keeping track of time. The Jewish scriptures birthed that idea, which is now practiced in all of the world today. Moreover, the idea of even having a seven-day period of time where one of those days is marked out as a day of rest, where we cease our work, that was a totally foreign concept in the ancient world outside of Israel. You think of every great empire, every great civilization that walked the earth back in the early days of Israel. None of them practiced a seven-day week. None of them gave a day off to their laborers and to the people, right? Not Greece, not Persia, Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, Rome. Nobody did that. So Israel has this totally countercultural, radical practice that's given to them as a gift from God to organize their whole time, their whole calendar around, to remember that they are a people intended to be with God and rest, to experience the presence of God, to rest with him. They're not made to be, like many of the other religions taught, slaves of the gods. That's not who a human person is in the Jewish scriptures, our Old Testament. They had a radically different way of looking at things, and that radically different way of looking at things didn't make a lot of sense to the rest of the ancient world. Even in the time of Jesus, people thought outside of Jewish culture that the Jewish Sabbath was a strange idea, that maybe it was lazy or they were suspicious about this particular day of the week and what happened and why it was set apart. They didn't get it. There was a Roman philosopher by the name of Seneca. He lived at the same time as Jesus in the first century, and he mocked the Jewish people for keeping the Sabbath. His critique was that they squandered 1/7 of their lives in inactivity. And there's a part of me that thinks, like, wow, he really didn't get it. You know, day off, that sounds awesome. And today, I'm sure we're really grateful for a 7-day week where you get a 2-day weekend, right? Can you imagine if there was no such thing as the weekend and it was just perpetual school, right? Like, what a nightmare situation that would be. So we're really grateful for this, right? On the one hand, we totally disagree with Seneca, like, wow, the Jewish culture, they got it right. All these other cultures, they were so wrong. I'm glad this went out. But on the other hand, I think we have a tendency sometimes in our lives, functionally and practically, to agree with Seneca and to agree with the other people. That Sabbath is something that can be a waste of time. It's not really for me. I don't need that. I can just work and entertain myself, and I'll take a nap when I need to, but I'm good. I don't need the Sabbath. We can be conscious of time. We want to use it well, right? Be productive. Get stuff done. Just this past week, I was thinking about how much time is given to sleep in like a week and in a lifetime. I had to pull out my phone calculator because I'm not very good at math, but I was realizing that, okay, if you live to be 81 years old and you sleep 8 hours a day, that's a third of your life. That means you're going to spend 27 years of your life unconscious lying on a bed. Like, so if I live to be 81, I basically am only going to be conscious for 54 of those years. And when I realized that, I just look at the numbers on my phone calculator, I was like, oh my gosh, I feel like somebody just ripped 27 years of my life away. Like, I'm going to die younger now that I've had this mathematical realization. And so there's this part of me that wants to, like, you know, sleep when you're dead, like, get stuff done, get after it, like, grind, you know, like, make life happen. And so the idea of pausing and resting and not just doing all the time, there's something in my soul, there's something in my heart and desires that wants to fight against that and to resist that. And there is, of course, something to be said for redeeming the time, for making the most of the time that God has given to us. Like, we need to live well and like, work hard and do those things. But I don't think that's our primary issue in our culture. Our primary issue is that we don't surrender time very well. Like, we don't know how to just give this up and live and actually rest. We have a different sort of problem. In your notes, I put it this way. We are better at striving to use time for our own advantage than surrendering time for our own formation. We're good at that, right? We want to strive, let's use time for the best that we can, but we're not so good at surrendering it for our own formation, for our well-being, to be with God. And so this is what the Sabbath is all about, right? Our discipleship in relation to time itself, right? It's a practice meant to shape the way that we think about time, how much of it we actually have, how fleeting and how fast it goes, our ability or lack thereof to control what happens in our time span of life, and what we need to do to use time well and to surrender it and let it go and be open-handed with it, right? So Sabbath is a practice meant to reorient us and to form us towards a proper view of and way of going about our lives in relation to time. That's what Sabbath is doing. It reminds us, we talked about the practice of simplicity last week, right? So simplicity, we said, is one of the practices that reminds us of the fact that our stuff is not our own. Like, all our stuff belongs to God and we're just stewards of that. And Sabbath is a lot like that, but in regards to time. Sabbath is a practice that reminds us that our time itself is not our own. Time itself belongs to God. We're only stewards. Like, we're living in time. We don't get to be outside of time and own it and possess it and control it and use it however we want. Time goes on even after we don't, right? Time is always flowing, always moving, even when you're asleep in your bed at night, long after you're dead and gone, time moves. We don't own it. We're just stewards living in this reality. So I want to read to you this description of life in a monastery. It's by a theologian, a spiritual teacher named Ronald Rollheiser. And I thought this is so good. He describes what life is like in a monastery, and this just kind of correlates, drives home the idea that our time is not our own. He says this: monks and nuns know that time is not their own, that they must often drop whatever they are doing and move on to what is being asked of them next. When the bell rings, St. Benedict once said, the monk must put down his pen without crossing his T or dotting his I. He must move on, not necessarily because he feels like doing something else, but because it is time. Time to eat, or pray, or work, or study, or sleep. Monks' lives are regulated by a bell, not because they don't have watches and alarm clocks, but to remind them always that time is not their own, and that there is a proper time to do things. Monks don't get to sleep, eat, pray, work, or relax when they feel like it, but when it is time to do those things. So a question for us to consider tonight is, what if we actually believed that our time belonged to God, that it's his and not ours, that he can make demands on our time, lay claim to it, because it's ultimately really his in the first place, right? Our time is not our own. What if we really believe that? I think we would go about our lives not always thinking, what do I want to do in this moment? Or how can I use this time really, really well? We'd be asking some questions that are different. We'd be asking questions like, what has God ordained for me in this season? Like, what does God have for me right now? For what purpose is this moment appointed? And questions like that would orient us to the reality that God is going to lay some claim to what we do in our day-to-day lives with our time. Like, we get 6 days a week. Do with what we will. You can go to school, you can skip class, you can do your homework, you can not do your homework, right? Chores, not chores. You can make decisions about what to do with your time 6 days a week. Some of them are going to be better decisions than others. But on that seventh day, God has laid claim. He has reclaimed that day for himself. And there's a tension here because it's a gift for you. But if you don't see it as a gift, if you see it as a burden, like Seneca did, right? Like the ancient world did outside of Judaism, then you're not going to receive that gift. You're not going to step into that life-giving practice of rest. You'll resist that, and you will miss out on what God has for you in the day that he has called holy and blessed. So Sabbath is meant to be for us like a bell summons, right? Like in the monastery when the bell rings, okay, I got to go to work now. And the bell rings, and okay, now it's time to pray. And the bell rings, okay, now it's time to go to chapel, right? And so it's a bell summons for us to say, hey, this time is set aside, this time is marked, now it's time to do this. Even if I didn't necessarily feel like it today, even if I don't feel necessarily tired, I'm still going to give myself to Sabbath because it's that time. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to step into that practice. And so the thing that we're probably all thinking, because I've thought this, and everybody for 3,000 years of Sabbath practice has thought this, the thing that runs through our minds is, that's a nice idea, but I don't have time. I am too busy. My life is too full. I can't afford to give myself to the practice of Sabbath. I don't have time for that. And so if that thought has crossed your mind, and you're thinking about the logistics and the practicality of, well, okay, how would I actually practice Sabbath? Like, am I going to have to, like, quit the soccer team or, you know, like, start skipping one of my classes or whatever, like, just take an F in this one to get by? Here's what I want to tell you. People have been practicing Sabbath for 3,000 years who have been a heck of a lot busier than you might feel, than you might actually be, right? And I don't want to discount your experience of having a lot on your plate, but Sabbath keeping, I promise you, is possible for you. And not only that, Sabbath keeping is advantageous. It is helpful. It is healthy. It is beneficial for you, mind, body, and soul. You can actually step into this practice. You have enough time. And that's not a comment about what you got on your schedule, right? When I tell you you have enough time, I'm not saying I looked at your calendar and I know you got nothing going on Saturday. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that we prioritize things in a certain way. We give value to things based on what we really believe is important in our lives. And if we value Sabbath and we see it as something that God has called us to, then we'll make time to practice it in our lives. And there are a lot of people, I can think of so many examples, so many stories of people who have bought into this idea. Like, Sabbath is good for some people, like the monks and the nuns, but I don't have time, right? I could tell you stories of doctors and tech industry executives, pastors, people who, you know, corporate lawyers, right, who've said, I can't practice, I don't have time for that. They're really working like 60, 70, 80 hours a week, something ridiculous like that. And they're able to keep that up for a while. And then all of a sudden, their body and their mind and their soul start screaming at them one day. Because what worked when they were 16 doesn't work anymore when they're 36, 46, 56. And you start getting all these like body you know, alarm bells ringing like, well, slow down. Like, I need rest. I need to recuperate. And people start to feel in their bodies and their souls like they're exhausted and tired, and they crash and they burn out and they can't sustain, they can't maintain their habits, their practice, their pace of life. And I don't want that to be you. And so even though right now, like, yeah, you could probably run all day, there's a trajectory of your life, the pace that you have in life, how much you work and how much you rest, and how much you produce and perform and consume, and how much you just are still. And you need to start developing good and healthy habits that will form you to be a person who knows how to give yourself time to rest, because it's important for you, mind, body, and soul. You are not infinite. One of the best things that as American teenage Christians you can start to get, like, to learn, to get inside your bones, is the idea that you need to learn to live within limits. You got to do that. Limitless screen time, limitless social interaction, limitless sleep, limitless anything is bad. Like, moderation, boundaries, discipline, limits, these things are good for your body and good for your soul. I want to share with you a quote. Leisure is not the privilege of those who have time, but rather the virtue of those who give to each instant of life the time it deserves. The time it deserves. So in other words, how much time in your week does Netflix deserve? Do you give that an appropriate estimation in your daily or your weekly routine, right? How much time does social media deserve? How much time do chores deserve? How much time does homework deserve? How much time do family meals deserve? We need to weigh and estimate and put boundaries and limits on these things so that we can live in proper proportion for what our souls and our bodies need. And so here's a promise and a secret. If you're following in your notes, learn to practice the Sabbath, and it won't just shape that one day. It will change how you experience the rest of your week. It's not just even about that one day. That will shape the way that you experience the rest of your week. Walter Brueggemann, he's an Old Testament scholar. He says, people who keep Sabbath live all 7 days differently. Like, your week, your perspective on time itself gets changed as you step into a regular rhythm of keeping the Sabbath. All that shifts. So how do we actually step into this? In your groups, I'm going to give you guys some time to parse this out and think through the experiment, but I want to offer you kind of two ways that we malpractice Sabbath, right? Two ways that we just kind of go off kilter and get this wrong, okay? The first one is legalism. Legalism. So in Jesus's day, right, Sabbath was a big deal. There's many, many stories in the gospel accounts of Jesus and having confrontations because of the way that he was practicing Sabbath. Jesus healed a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath, and he was rebuked by the religious authorities. He made a paralyzed man walk, and he was rebuked. His disciples gathered food as they walked through a field. All this is happening on the Sabbath, and Jesus, again, was rebuked. And so Jesus' summary teaching in all those instances was this. It was kind of twofold. He said, on the one hand, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. And he also said the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Echoing that idea that the Sabbath is a gift. So when Jesus taught that he was the Lord of the Sabbath, right, that echoes Moses' instruction in Exodus, where the Ten Commandments are given and the Sabbath is first introduced to the people of God. And Moses tells the people the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord, your God. So Jesus is saying, I am the Lord who the Sabbath is consecrated, who is set apart for. Like, it's for me. I am the Lord of the Sabbath. So I have authority to say what this can look like in the lives of my people. It's like in Parks and Rec. Y'all seen the show Parks and Rec, right? Ben Wyatt, he's involved in this game playing the Cones of Dunshire with these, like, tech nerds later seasons. And they think they got him beat and that there's no way he can, like, you know, actually keep up with them. And then it turns out he, you know, wipes the floor with them and wins this game, this kind of epic reversal at the end, and he wins the Cones of Dunshire. And why does he win? Because he's literally the inventor of the game, right? And it's kind of like that with Jesus. Like, Jesus saying, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath, so I have the authority to know how to practice this, right? So I can step into this and say what goes and how we actually do this as the people of God. Jesus is like, trust me, I know the Sabbath, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. And the principle for us in keeping Sabbath is that the rules are not Lord. Jesus is Lord. So you don't have to worry about, oh, am I doing it wrong? Is God going to be ticked? Like, no. It is not about the letter of the law. Jesus fulfilled the law, fulfilled the Sabbath for us, and he gives us himself. He is the gift. He is the Lord of the Sabbath. So that's the first thing, legalism. Avoid that. The second thing, the way we malpractice Sabbath is selfishness. Selfishness. In Jesus' second teaching, the Sabbath was made for man, right? That is not a license for indulgence. When Jesus says the Sabbath was made for man, he's not saying, go crazy, kids. Like, go nuts. Have a good time. It's party. It's the weekend. Let's rage. That's not what Jesus is saying when he says the Sabbath was made for man. It means that Jesus is restoring the experience of Sabbath as a gift to his people. The Sabbath had become a burden, right? Something that was not life-giving, that was not rooted in joy and the experience of God with his people. So Jesus is restoring the experience of Sabbath as a gift to people. He's embodying the joy of life under God's rule as he blessed and liberated people from all sorts of bondage, physical and spiritual. And when he says that, he is echoing more teaching on the Sabbath from the Old Testament. This time, Deuteronomy 5:15, which says, and this is all in the context of teaching the Sabbath, remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. So one of the reasons that the people were supposed to keep the Sabbath was as a remembrance that they came from a culture in which they were worked to the bone day in and day out. And you know what it's like to not have rest. So be a people of rest, right? The Sabbath is a reminder for us in that sense of the gospel that we have been freed from the oppressive taskmasters of productivity and performance, and we now get to live under the kind and good and just rule of God. So we're not in bondage anymore to Egypt, to empire, to productivity, to any of that stuff. We get to resist all that. Can you imagine, like, if the people of Israel had been able to practice Sabbath during their time in Egypt? There's no way Pharaoh was going to let that slide, right? The taskmasters in Egypt can't allow the people that they've oppressed and enslaved to do work for them, to take a day off. No, that's counterculture. This is why Walter Brueggemann, again, the scholar, he says that the Sabbath is an act of resistance. Pastor A.J. Swoboda calls it scheduled social justice. Because Sabbath is disruptive to a culture that feeds off an endless, limitless cycle of produce, consume, produce, consume, produce, consume. And Sabbath is a way where we say, okay, let's pause. I am not a human machine. I'm a human being. I'm not made. I'm not built to work tirelessly. I don't need to always produce and consume. I need rest. And I'm going to do that with God. He is the source and the goal, the end of my life. So Sabbath is a time for us to resist that cycle, that culture, that rhythm, and to step away and just to be with God. It's an act of resistance to being formed as a hurried, anxious, striving person. Now, here's the thing. Sabbath is a feast day, all right? So in the church calendar, we talk about different seasons and days and whether fast days or feast days. Sabbath is a feast day, okay? So I've tried to clarify for us that Sabbath is not about excessive indulgence, okay? But it is supposed to be fun. Sabbath is a celebratory occasion. It's not a day of fasting. It is a day of feasting. So when you're practicing Sabbath, you need to think through, how can I practice some recreation? Maybe you want to paint, maybe you want to journal, maybe you want to go for a walk, maybe you want to play a sport, whatever. Like, but practice some recreation, do something fun, be with your family, talk to people that you love, read a good book, take some solo time if you need, right? But do something that is life-giving for your body and mind and soul. Worship, recreate, love God, love neighbor. So to use another Parks and Rec thing, right? It's not a treat yourself day. This is not the day of excess and indulgence, but it is a day of feasting and celebration. So treat it as such. Approach it with the proper mentality and balance. For me and for Mara, we practice Sabbath on Friday because we work on Sundays, and so we set aside a different day to practice Sabbath. A lot of people in church do that. So for us, what that typically looks like is we wake up, we sleep in, we do a brunch date together, we'll go for a walk with our dog, we'll take some solo time to go and read on our own, we'll watch a little bit of TV, and then we'll prep for the meal that night, and we'll go over to a friend's house. We do this every single Friday. We go over to a friend's house, we make dinner together, we hang out with them and their kids, and we stay up late talking and playing cards, and then we go home. And every time, it's fun. We do this big meal, this big dessert. It's celebratory. It's fun. It's something we look forward to day in and day out. Like, oh, I can't wait till it's Friday because it's Sabbath day and it's going to be good. And I don't write sermons on Friday, right? Like, I try not to answer emails. I try not to, you know, do retail therapy. Like, Friday is a special day. It's for me and for Mari. It's for me and God. It's for me and our friends and our family. So that's a day of rest and celebration. It's going to look different for you. I totally get that, and it can and it should. So make it your own. But all I want to do tonight as we close is to invite you into this practice. Have some imagination. Experiment. Start small if you need, but step into the practice of Sabbath. Even if you're not a follower of Jesus, Sabbath will surprise you. And I think that if you step into a practice of rest, you'll find that it's not just a rule and a burden of something to do, but you might actually encounter the Lord of the Sabbath. And that is the whole point of the Sabbath anyways, that we would enter into the rest that Jesus gives us in himself. And as we step into Sabbath, we're rehearsing the rest that is to come at the end of all things. So as you go into your groups, you're going to practice, or you're going to think through how you can practice that in this coming week. Let me pray for you. Jesus, we come to you weary, heavy laden, looking for rest for our souls. I thank you that you extended and offer it to us. I pray that we would have eyes to see what we need to be less attached to in our time, what we need to make room for in our schedule so that we can be with you, so we can experience the joy that comes from worship and recreation and be renewed body, mind, and soul. So Lord, help us to see what you want us to see as you go into a time of discussion, to prepare our hearts to engage in something that might be new for many of us in this coming week. In your name, amen. Y'all dismissed your groups.